listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Tuesday's briefing at the U.S. State Department covered a variety of hotspots in the world, from Algeria to Venezuela, and many spots in between. This is State Department spokesperson Robert Palladino speaking at the State Department in Washington on Tuesday.
Thank you. The United States applauds the people of Venezuela for their actions to create a peaceful democratic transition and congratulates Interim President Juan Guaido on his successful diplomatic efforts in the region and safe return to Venezuela. However, we have noticed in news coverage that some outlets are incorrectly referring to Juan Guaido as the opposition leader or the self-proclaimed president. Neither is correct. A few basic facts. The National Assembly remains the only legitimate and democratically elected institution in Venezuela. Juan Guaido was elected president of the National Assembly on January 5th, 2019. And on January 10th, Maduro usurped the presidency. Therefore, the president of the National Assembly, and relying on Venezuela's constitution, as president of the National Assembly and relying on Venezuela's constitution, Juan Guaido became interim president of Venezuela on January 23rd. Millions of Americans and more than 50 countries recognize Juan Guaido as interim president of Venezuela. He has appointed and credentialed ambassadors to international organizations and the United States and numerous other democratic nations and other democratic nations. So to refer to Juan Guaido as anything but interim president falls into the narrative of a dictator who has usurped the position of the presidency and led Venezuela into the humanitarian, political, and economic crisis that exists today. The international community must unite behind interim President Juan Guaido and the Venezuelan National Assembly and support the peaceful restoration of democracy in Venezuela. That's it for the top.
Let me get this straight. You're complaining because news outlets are calling him by a title that you don't think that he...
Not a complaint, pointing out, just trying to correct.
Well, it sounds like a complaint to me, and that seems pretty weak sauce. I don't understand what your problem is. I mean,
he's the interim president.
Well,
and we don't want
you
to
consider him to be the interim president. And as you say, 50 other countries outside of recognize him as the interim president. But there are more than 190 members of the United Nations. So your 50 countries is not even close to half. Is that correct?
We are supporting the Constitution of Venezuela and the people of Venezuela. We're supporting the Venezuelan people here, and so the United States. It's the time to act in support of democracy.
And news coverage of calling him the legitimate leader, the president, is going to encourage more countries to recognize.
We don't want to feed into rhetoric of the current dictator.
Okay. Very briefly, the policy question. Yesterday, you guys got a letter from three House committees, once again bringing up this the request for to either speak with the interpreter who was present during President Trump's meeting with President Putin in Finland. Or notes and communications regarding that. I saw the answer that you provide, the department provided yesterday, which is basically we got the letter, but we're not going to talk about our cooperation with a different agency. I would like to know, because when Heather was up here, when this first came up last year, immediately after the summit, she didn't really give a full answer. So I want to know, is it the department's practice policy to make available to relevant congressional committees its staff interpreters or the interpreter's notes or whatever to is it standard practice, or is this something that has been denied in the past, or has it never come up?
Matt, it's a fair question, but I just don't know the answer to that today. I don't have that answer for you, but I will get you an answer on that.
Someone check to find out. Yeah. I'd just like to know if the building in its vast history if there's precedence for agreeing to a request like this, or if there's precedence for denying.
I believe the answer is no, but I want to look into it. Okay, before I give you
no, as in it's never been asked for.
It's not been brought.
So this is uncharted territory.
That is. That I want to look into and get you a proper answer.
Thanks.
Okay, yeah, please, Rich. You had a question.
Venezuela, okay.
Venezuela,
mm-hmm.
Okay, sure.
The measure announced yesterday in regards to property in Cuba. How much does the Cuban government's support of the Venezuelan government, or one of them, how much does that play into the secretary's decision?
I'd say quite a bit. I mean, Cuba's support for the Maduro regime has been significant, and therefore part of our overarching policy is to squeeze Cuba as appropriate, we would like to see democracy returned to Venezuela.
One quick follow-up.
Sure.
You have sanctioned, or the United States has sanctioned, the state oil company. Is there a concern that you are sort of running out of options to press the Maduro regime, and there's not as much to hold over the Maduro regime's head as far as potential or future sanctions or measures the United States or world community would take to usher him out? And is there a concern that it's reaching a static point, or there's a loss of momentum for the opposition or the Guaido presidency?
We're optimistic. I think we're up to, I think I've got the latest numbers, up to 54 countries have now recognized Juan Guaido as interim president. The humanitarian response global has been overwhelming. That's something we're going to continue to push. And we call now is the time to act in support of democracy. We think momentum is good. We're going to continue to look at ways that we can support Venezuela's humanitarian needs on one side, and we're going to continue to ask other nations to do the same. There's been positive news recently of some Venezuelan military and security service personnel standing on the right side of history and recognizing Juan Guaido as interim president. So we're going to continue pushing.
Since you just mentioned the number again, Robert, 54, that's only about a quarter of the U.S. Of countries in the world. Is that right?
If you know the number of countries, but we've gotten major support in the Western Hemisphere, and I would just point that out, as well as Europe. If we look at the democracies, we're doing pretty well as well. Okay? Michelle, all right.
Following on the secretary's visit, considering that the Israeli election is next month, a month from today, is it likely that he would go there before the election? Would that send some sort of a message?
No message. Israel's an ally. We're not going to get involved in domestic politics of another country. Please.
Okay. Let me just follow up on the embassy, please.
I'm going to go to Lalit. I'm going to jump.
You're not going to get involved in domestic politics of another country when that country is Israel. What about Venezuela? Huh?
We're supporting the Venezuelan people and their constitutional. Lalit, let's go. I'll come back to you. Okay, go ahead. You next, Lalit, all right? Saeed.
You closed the consulate in Jerusalem yesterday.
Right.
After 175 years of operation. But you're saying the decision was driven by our global efforts to increase the efficiency and effectiveness of our diplomatic engagements and operations. Could you really explain what that means? What does that mean?
It means exactly what it says. We've got... this is an internal administrative decision about how we staff and organize our representation overseas, and that's exactly what it is.
This is an internal administrative decision, but frankly, it's not. I won't try and argue the point with you here. I have a technical question about this. What happens to the building?
The building we continue to house and use. The Palestinian Affairs Unit is now stood up within that building, and
it will stay there.
Correct.
So, in other words, this building will be used. It's going to be used for the same purpose as it was on last week. Mm-hmm. It's just going to have a different name. It won't be run by a consul general who reports directly back.
Correct. Okay. Chain of command now reports to the United States ambassador.
Is it going to become a resident for the American ambassador in Israel?
I don't have any information
because
on that.
Because we live before that. Becoming...
Don't have. I promise. Lalit. Yeah, just go ahead.
Sorry. Thank you. I have two questions on South Asia, India, and Pakistan. What is U.S. assessment of the situation between the two countries now? And also, can you give us a sense or describe in detail what efforts the secretary himself made in calming the situation? He spoke to the two leaders in India-Pakistan earlier this week, and he spoke about it yesterday too in the Iowa.
Right. The position of the United States is we continue to urge both sides to continue to take steps to de-escalate the situation, and that includes through direct communication. And we believe strongly that further military activity will exacerbate the situation. So we reiterate our call for Pakistan to abide by its United Nations Security Council commitments to deny terrorist sanctuary and to block their access to funds. Regarding your second question, this happened in Hanoi last week, actually. Secretary Pompeo led diplomatic engagement directly, and that played an essential role in de-escalating the tensions between the two sides. He spoke with leaders in both countries, and that included the Indian Minister of External Affairs, Swaraj, National Security Advisor, Doval, and Pakistani Foreign Minister, Qureshi. Since, I'll stop there. Okay. Is there any follow-up? Is there a follow-up on that? I'm sorry, please go ahead.
So has he made any further calls since coming here after that?
He hasn't. But what I can say is we've been in continuous high-level contact has continued. That's with both governments via our embassies in New Delhi and Islamabad, as well as with the Indian and Pakistani embassies here in Washington. That has been sustained. That's been ongoing. And sometimes we do public diplomacy, and sometimes there's a time for private diplomacy, and there's a lot of private diplomacy that's going on right now.
One quick thing. India has, on use of F-16 by Pakistan, State Department and the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad said it is looking for more information on that, either in potential misuse of F-16 by Pakistan, and what information you are seeking from.
So we've seen those reports, and we're following that issue very closely. I can't confirm anything, but as a matter of policy, we don't publicly comment on the contents of bilateral agreements that we have in this regard involving U.S. defense technologies, nor the communications that we have with other countries about that. So we're taking a look, and we're going to continue to take a look. And I'm going to leave it at that. Let's move on.
Questions on State Department business.
I'm going to go to Michelle. That's why I already called on you. Let's go to Lori. Let me go to Lori.
I have a question.
We'll try to get back.
Turkey's plans to purchase the S-400. How does that stand now, and what will you do if they go ahead with that?
Yeah. We've spoken about that before here, Lori, and position hasn't changed. We've long made it clear we would like to work collaboratively on air and missile defense with Turkey, and we have offered opportunities for Turkey to consider Patriot, among other systems, over the years. We've also made it clear to Turkey that we have very serious concerns with its stated plans to proceed with the acquisition of the Russian S-400 missile defense system. We've clearly warned Turkey that its potential acquisition of the S-400 will result in a reassessment of Turkey's participation in the F-35 program and risk other potential future arm transfers to Turkey, as well as lead to potential sanctions under Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, CATSA, upon any government entities, private industry, or individuals that are involved in such a transaction.
Thank you. And if I could ask you about the latest on Syria. You're leaving, we understand. There'll be 400 U.S. troops that will remain in Syria after the departure, with additional forces from coalition members. Is that correct?
The White House has indicated those numbers, and I'll defer to the White House and Department of Defense on specifics, but what I will say is that a residual force of the United States military is going to remain in northeast Syria as part of a multinational force in order to prevent ISIS resurgence and to support stability and security in northeast Syria.
it means that there will be more troops from the international coalition that will join the U.S. forces?
We are, the drawdown is going to continue. As previously announced, it's going to be done in a deliberate and coordinated manner. And as we transition, we're going to continue to be working with our allies and partners to clear liberated areas, conduct targeted counterterrorism operations, and support stabilization efforts. As far as our priorities remain the same, and talks are ongoing with our allies about the
multinational force.
Yeah,
multinational force.
Franco, follow up on that.
When you say multinational force, what are the other nations? What pledges do you have for this force?
We're not going into details. Talks continue. We have nothing to announce.
You don't have any pledge to announce.
Go. Please.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Question on Saudi Arabia. Given the case that was publicized this week of an American woman who, due to circumstances surrounding a divorce, is unable to leave Saudi Arabia, I wondered if the State Department has any concerns about the guardianship laws generally in Saudi Arabia and the effect it has on women there.
Just speaking generally about anytime an American travels overseas, they're, of course, subject to the laws of the country in which they travel. And we routinely encourage American citizens to make sure, to read what we publish and to understand the laws of the countries to which they're visiting. In the case of Saudi Arabia, as you point out, married women, including non-Saudis, require their husband's permission to depart the country, while unmarried women and children require the permission of their father or male guardian. So that's something that we work through.
Right. Can I ask one follow-up on that and another American?
With the International Women of Courage Award.
We continue to engage all countries on the issue of women and girls' rights, and that's something we speak forthrightly about.
Well, why can't you say it in this case about Saudi Arabia, unless it's not a concern with Saudi Arabia? If all you're doing is warning American women who are married to Saudis that if they go there, they might not ever be able to leave, that doesn't sound like you're trying to change
the policy. We engage with the Saudi government and all nations on these issues. It's something that we do routinely in our diplomacy. It's something that we continue to stand up for, and something that is part of what we, as the diplomatic corps, do globally. I'll stop there. All right.
One follow-up question on that.
Let's do one North Korea. How about one North Korea?
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll do Janice. You got a North Korea. Let's hear.
Thank you very much. On United States and North Korea, Hanoi talks broke down in last week. What are the next steps in the United States? Is there any plan to have the next meeting with North Korea? The United States have any plan to next meeting with North Korea? What do you have the schedule?
Not yet.
But Pompeo said, Secretary Pompeo said there will be sent a special envoy to North Korea. Do we have any plans?
We have no travel to announce for Special Representative Biegun yet. We've just returned from that trip, and we're going to regroup, and we're going to drive forward.
Special Representative Biegun will meeting with the South Korean Representative Lee Do-hoon. Do you have anything on this? Because he's arriving.
I'm sorry, Jen. One more time. Can you say that again?
South Korean Representative Lee Do-hoon will meeting with the Special Representative Biegun. Right. Today or tomorrow.
Will happen tomorrow.
Yes.
I can confirm that meeting will take place.
We'll be talking about this issue.
Of course.
This is
his counterpart. And so there's very close coordination with the Republic of Korea on this regard.
So, Robert, when you say
no plans, right?
I'm sorry?
We don't have any plan to special envoy to send.
At this point, I've got nothing to announce. No.
All right, thanks.
Absolutely. When you say that,
in the next couple of weeks, he said, I hope to have a team in Pyongyang headed over there in the next couple of weeks.
He says hope. He says hope, and we do hope. We want to move this forward. Absolutely. But I've got nothing to announce today. And the secretary is expressing where we want to go. We think we made progress in Hanoi, and we're gonna operate from that.
So are you saying that there hasn't been State Department contact with any North Koreans since the summit?
I didn't say that, actually. No. So
what is the answer then? Has the U.S. been talking to the North Koreans since the summit?
I'm not going to go into private diplomatic channels, but we remain, I would say, as a general principle, we remain in regular contact with the North Koreans. And progress was made at the Hanoi summit. We did not reach an agreement. But at the same time, we were able to exchange very detailed positions, and that has narrowed the gap on a number of issues. And we've also made clear where the United States and the world stand regarding demilitarization.
But you can't say whether there's been conversation by the State Department since the summit?
I'm not going to go into specifics on private discussions.
But that wouldn't
I would
be
say
private. A yes
we
or no
are,
that
we
you've
are
talked,
in regular
not be giving
we
away
remain
anything.
In regular contact with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Please, yes.
Regarding Special Representative Lee Jae-myung, will there also be a trilet with Japan this week included?
I can confirm that he's meeting with his Japanese counterpart tomorrow as well.
Tomorrow as
yes.
well. Tomorrow. Thank you.
Please.
The U.S. also is concerned about the future of women in Afghanistan with these ongoing talks with the Taliban, and if the Taliban returns to government in Afghanistan.
Special Representative Khalilzad and his team are working to promote intra-Afghan talks through a national, unified, and inclusive Afghan negotiating team that includes opposition parties and representatives from civil society, particularly women and youth. And so our position is we're going to continue to support a peace process that aims to address the legitimate concerns of the Afghan people and sustains the social and economic gains of the last 17 years. And that means ensures a better future for all Afghans, particularly women and youth.
All right. One question about Saudi back here.
A Saudi question. Okay.
Virginia lawmakers have written to Secretary Pompeo asking him to raise the case of Aziza al-Yusuf, who's been in jail for almost a year, says she was tortured. She's a woman activist there. Wondered if the secretary has raised that case, and also the case of the American man who says he was tortured in Saudi custody, the U.S. citizen.
Who is the Saudi man that you're referring to?
It's the Saudi American man who was in the Ritz-Carlton. New York Times profiled him this weekend.
Okay. Right. It's Waleed Fitahi is the gentleman's name, right?
Yeah.
We confirm that he's detained in Saudi Arabia. Confirm that we're providing him consular services, and that we have raised his case with the government of Saudi Arabia. We visited him today. We visited him on the 20th, and we have had consular access previously. We've raised and we continue to raise his case on a consistent basis with the Saudi government.
And anything you can tell us about his condition, since you've saw him today?
I have no updates on that regard, no.
And anything? And about the woman who's the
And I don't have that in front of me today. I'm sorry. I just don't want to misspeak on that issue. But I would say we, I don't have the facts of that case, so I don't want to misspeak, Michelle. All right, please.
Do you have anything on this?
I'm sorry,
Congress,
Michelle.
Is considering sanctions on Saudi Arabia.
We don't preview, sanctions, and I've got nothing to announce in that regard. All right,
Robert,
last question. We're going to wrap it up, and I'm going to try you, please.
Okay, senators had a closed door briefing yesterday with a senior State Department official, and Lindsey Graham said it was a waste of time. Mitt Romney said he learned nothing new. If senators learned nothing new, what was the point of the briefing? And the other question, really quickly, on Israel. Israel's prime minister is facing indictments. I know you said you don't get involved in domestic issues, but how does that and does it affect the administration's peace plan?
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on the second question. Israel is an ally. We deal with the government of Israel, and that's the way we pursue our own interests as the United States of America. We take countries as we find them. Regarding your first question, that was a closed-door session, and I'm not going to, attempt to read out what was briefed, and I'm certainly not going to react to, members, our elected representatives, not going to do that from the State Department. We continue to regularly engage the United States Congress on these issues and to provide information. Our position has not changed. We continue to gather facts. We'll follow them where they lead and to hold those responsible.
Including the Crown Prince?
We have repeatedly said that we will follow the facts where they lead and hold those who are responsible. And with that, I'm going to stop. Guys, thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Traditionally, in the foreign policy blob, with the assistance of the legacy media, define an immediate threat for a foreign military intervention or coup. Their aim has been to manufacture public support. Today, it's different. With virtually no public debate, Venezuela is the target of a forced regime change. The problem is, forced regime change has a deplorable record. Crosstalking Forced Regime Change, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Hamlin in Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And in Paris, we have Guillaume Long. He is a former foreign affairs minister of Ecuador, currently an associate researcher at the Institute of Strategic and International Relations. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Guillaume in Paris. Over the last few days, John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, was on CNN with Jake Tapper, and he said the following: I'd like to see a broad coalition as we can put together, to replace Maduro, to replace the whole corrupt regime. He also invoked the Monroe Doctrine. Being a former foreign minister of a Latin American country, how do you receive those words?
Hi, and thanks for having me on your show. I think the coalition, instead of being strengthened, or at least the coalition the U.S. has in mind, instead of being strengthened, is being gradually weakened, certainly over the last few days. There was kind of this, there was a momentum a few weeks ago around Guaido. There was some hope, I think, on behalf of the U.S. administration and some of its allies, that the pressure would mount, that there would be the street protests would put pressure on the military. Then around the 23rd of February, the whole issue around aid being brought in through Colombia and whether some Venezuelan battalions or regiments would switch side, and this would trigger a domino effect. So this momentum, I think, has essentially passed. And I think you're seeing a lot of actors. We've been hearing European voices over the last few days, including the Spanish foreign minister, saying, well, we expected that it would be quick, we expected that things would be much faster, and they haven't unfolded this way. Borrell, the Spanish foreign minister, even sort of indirectly blamed the United States for sort of leading this initiative and sort of misleading almost Europeans. I mean, Europeans shouldn't be misled, they should have their own policy, but you know, this was the kind of what was being hinted at. And certainly I agree that there's a loss of momentum, and this coalition that Bolton is calling for, instead of being strengthened, it's being weakened. You're seeing a number of Latin American states getting cold feet, saying, okay, we want regime change. A lot of Latin American neighbors, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, and others want regime change, but they don't want a military intervention. That's for your first point. And on your second point, I just think it is unbelievably clumsy and just so telling of the kind of unilateralism and sort of imperial arrogance we're getting from this administration. I mean, for a number of years and for a number of administrations, you've had that kind of arrogance towards Latin America, but it hasn't been spelled out in so many ways.
Yeah.
To talk of the Monroe Doctrine for Latin Americans is a real insult, and it's really going back to this sort of backyard approach to Latin America as a region.
You know, Michael, I mean, if we go back to Bolton's words, you know, replace the whole corrupt regime. I mean, I thought it was about democracy. Now it's about corruption. But if it's about corruption, then why don't the United States have forced regime change in Saudi Arabia? It's corrupt and repressive. I mean, it's quite selective, isn't it, Michael?
Hi, Peter. Well, first, I agree with the foreign minister's points, generally speaking. And second, I agree with your concern, as you expressed in the introduction, that regime change has a very poor record, especially in modern times. And I don't see how we can do it militarily, even if we wanted to. And moreover, I don't see why we would want to do it without the complete support of Russia and China. I think we need to operate as a unified Security Council, which means the only kind of realistic approach here is going to combine diplomatic and economic measures. And the more support we have, the better. As the foreign minister just pointed out, there was a certain amount of consensus with Canada, the United States, and most Latin American countries supporting Guaido. But the question is, how do you make it happen in a situation where whatever Maduro's legitimacy, and I think it's very weak, so on that point, I do agree with Mr.
Bolton. What about Guaido's legitimacy? What does this random guy, does he have legitimacy?
Well, under the Constitution, I think he does.
No, he doesn't.
Under the Constitution, I think under well... No.
Well, I have it right here. It's Article 231. I recommend you take a look at it, okay? Because I actually read the Constitution, not the New York Times. Keep going, Michael.
I think that Guaido is commonly recognized to be the legitimate ruler by much of Latin America. But it doesn't really matter what Latin America and the United States think unless we have some viable means to create a legitimate succession process without using military force. That's where I am having my troubles now.
Okay, let's go back to Paris here. I mean, why should the United States or any other country in the hemisphere determine the government of Venezuela? I don't get that, okay? What about sovereignty? What about self-determination? I mean, considering the record of the opposition over the last 2 years of not even involving themselves in elections and not even being unified themselves. I mean, they're not particularly interested in democracy from what I can see. They're interested in power and power only. And you have outside players like Canada now leading this. Isn't it up to the Venezuelan people to figure this out? Go ahead in Paris.
Yeah, I think there's been a change of a political sign and color in the Latin American region.
Yeah.
And Venezuela kind of still stands out as being on the left, broadly speaking. I mean, I would be critical about some of the things that are happening in Venezuela.
I agree.
Certainly since 2014, there have been a lot of problems, a big economic mismanagement, also the commodity collapse and a number of things that have happened that have created a huge political, institutional, social and economic crisis. But sure, I mean, regime change is not the way forward. In fact, the countries that are supporting Guaido And I don't agree that Article 233 of the Constitution enables Guaido in any way. It talks, it's very clear that it's in the absence of the president, and yes. Maduro hasn't been absent at all. So we're dealing here with legitimacy, which is a much more sort of ambiguous concept, and we have to be very, very careful. But in any event, 50 countries have recognized Guaido, mostly the US and its allies, but there are 193 states members in the United Nations, so you know it's still very divided. And I would agree with Michael. I think, broadly speaking, the issue has to be resolved through negotiations inside Venezuela, so people sort of de-escalating inside Venezuela, and negotiation at the international level also. I mean, we're clearly seeing at the UN Security Council there's no consensus there. And the reason why I believe in negotiation is because I know Venezuela well. I know that Chavismo exists, and this is the mistake that has been made by the US and some of its allies. They've been kind of inventing this narrative that the whole of Venezuela sees Maduro as a dictator, which is not the case. Some people are critical. Some people are critical of him, but even more critical of the opposition. Some of the basis of Chavismo who don't necessarily like Maduro, but certainly don't like Guaido. So the situation is complex, and more polarization is dangerous and could lead us to civil war. And a civil war in this kind of Cold War context that we've been living through in the last few months in Latin America could mean international war in Latin America as well. So my big message, cause, concern here is negotiation, dialogue.
I
really think that that the momentum's passed, this is the moment to do it.
The government has been asking that repeatedly, okay? And we, in the opposition, obviously, with the backing of the United States, it looks like the United States and outside countries are calling this coup and not the opposition and their random guy that has been picked from the outside. Michael, I mean, can you reflect upon all of the regime change, all of the meddling that Latin and South America has experienced from the United States for a very, very long time? Why do they keep doing it? I mean, its road record is pretty deplorable. And then you have someone like Elliot Abrams, you know, plucked out of obscurity, as it were, considering his record during the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan administration. I mean, what kind of signal is that sending to the entire region that a henchman is back on the job? Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I mean, Peter, you and I don't always agree 100%, but
we very rarely agree
that the United States does not. actually, we agree about half the time. But I take the broad spirit of what you're saying, which is the United States is not in a position politically, historically, to lead some kind of a strong-armed effort here by itself. We need to work with the Lima Group. We need to listen to voices like the former foreign minister on the show, and I'm delighted to be on the show with him, speaking from Paris. We need to do this as part of a hemisphere-wide process and with Russia and China. This is an example of the kind of problem we have to solve with our friends on the Security Council.
But John Bolton isn't really cut from that cloth. I think we would agree on that. He doesn't like negotiations. He actually doesn't like diplomacy, and he doesn't like agreements and treaties. I mean, that is his entire time in this White House is to undo everything that was so much hard work was put into, okay? Past agreements may have had flaws, but they certainly could be addressed here. So do you think John Bolton's going to wake up in the middle of the night and say, I know how to get out of this impasse. Let's negotiate. That isn't going to happen, Michael. 40 seconds before we go to the break.
Well, John Bolton works for President Trump. It's a fascinating relationship. A lot of us are studying it. I know you're watching it carefully, too. Bolton does have his own worldview, but he works for a guy who doesn't really relish the idea of more foreign military interventions and would like to find some way to repair his relationship with Vladimir Putin, if at all possible. So it makes for a very complex chemistry that I haven't figured out exactly myself.
Well, in terms of a better relationship with Russia, I think that that could only happen if there is a second Trump term. And right before the program, we were starting of talking about the presidential sweepstakes. And it's going to be an interesting almost 2 years before we get there. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on forced regime change. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World
on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Paris. Guillaume, it's not just Venezuela that is being targeted right now. We've also heard from the National Security Advisor that expect the same for Venezuela and Cuba. How does that go down in the region, considering the legacy of American meddling south of the border here? And again, I mean, and Michael knows this because he's been on the program enough times. I'm a pretty hardcore conservative, and I lived in communist Eastern Europe. I am no fan of any form of socialism, okay? But I'm much more interested in protecting the sovereignty of these countries and for people to determine what their own domestic affairs will be. So, I mean, I'm in actually a kind of an odd situation to be in because those regimes certainly wouldn't be of my preference. But they are sovereign. Go ahead in Paris.
I think there is a big issue to do with sovereignty, and particularly what happened in the first, I would say, decade and a half in Latin America after the terrible 80s and 90s. Yep. I mean, in Latin America, neoliberalism, which was this kind of huge wave of deregulation, was not carried out in the context of strong states. Yeah, it was carried out in the context of an absolute absence of institutions and states. So the result of that was the growth of poverty, the growth of inequality, the growth of anarchy, the abuse of power of all the already powerful, etc., etc. So from Chavez onwards, from 1999, when Chavez comes to power onwards, and then Lula in 2003, the Kirchners in 2003, then you have Evo Morales in 2005, Correa in 2007, so on and so on. You have what has often been called in English the pink tide. And it was it lasted a long time, certainly an unprecedented phase of a political stability, I would say, in Latin America, of sort of, you know, enduring governments. Broadly speaking of the political left, although very heterogeneous, center-left, some much more Bolivarian, you know, it's very heterogeneous, pink tide. I actually think that, going back to your question, both the Latin American elites who were forced to redistribute some wealth, and Latin American elites are very wealthy, and some power, and the U.S., which was forced to kind of accommodate in a hemisphere where it hasn't been used to accommodate. And this has to do with your point on sovereignty. You know, China came along, but even European Union sort of asserted itself in Latin America, Russia, and other countries from the BRICS and the Global South. Latin America diversified its relations and asserted its sovereignty. I worked for a government, Rafael Correa's government in Ecuador, who got rid of the biggest U.S. military base in Latin America. It was in Ecuador, Manta military base, and we said in 2009, we said thanks, but no thanks. We don't want foreign troops on our territory. In fact, the Constitution had made it constitutional. So we said goodbye to you. Those kinds of assertions of sovereignty, I think, have not been forgiven by the United States. So I think a lot of what you're seeing today, particularly by a very sort of binary, aggressive, hawkish, Trumpian administration, and certainly the ones that are dealing with Latin America, so, you know, Elliot Abrams, you mentioned, and of course Bolton, but also Mike Pompeo, their approach towards Latin America is sort of nostalgic of the Reagan era, Nicaragua style, El Salvador style, and they just want to impose U.S. Hegemony over the region. And that affects Cuba, which we were just seeing in the last few days. Helms-Burton, which had always been repealed, sort of coming back to the fore, general aggressiveness towards leftist actors in the region, and strong backing for very right-wing regimes.
You know, Michael, reflect upon that, because, you know, it is kind of hearkening back to a very terrible past. Particularly the Elliot Abrams interim that we all remember. And there's a lack of subtlety about American foreign policy. I mean, going back to the Monroe Doctrine, I mean, I was astounded that Bolton would even mention that. And he mentioned it in the way that he probably didn't care if anybody south of the border heard it. It's that kind of arrogance and lack of subtlety that really shows, you know, doesn't show goodwill. And is it really an anti-socialist, pro-democracy crusade when the same gentleman, Bolton, openly talked about it would be nice to have Venezuela's oil capacity in American hands? I mean, the arrogance of that. I mean, what is that a policy that that the people in south of the border should have confidence in?
First, I would agree, Peter, with your criticism of this use of the Monroe Doctrine term. It has a very, very loaded past, and I don't know why we would want to bring it up. It doesn't mean good things in the hemisphere. Secondly, my friend in Paris, the former foreign minister, knows that when Ecuador told us to leave, we did leave. So it's not like we are just trying to wield our weight at all cost in an imperialistic way. But the history is still there, and we have to remember that, and that's going to color how we are seen. And the last thing I would say, agreeing with the foreign minister, the big problems in Latin America, throughout the hemisphere, whether the governments lean left or lean right, the big problems are poverty and crime,
yeah,
much more so than war between states, much more so than these high-level political debates that we're having on the show today. It's poverty and crime. And we should be supportive of any government that can make headway against those without trying to bring back the ideological baggage of the Cold War.
I think that it's absolutely correct, Michael. I agree with you 100% here. Let's go back to Paris here. I mean, I'm trying to understand the rhyme and reason of it all. We had this spectacle on the bridge bringing in, of course, it was all done for the cameras. It was a psych op operation. It was obvious. And it went south, quite literally, I suppose. It didn't come to fruition. But this is the United States is a country that is sanctioning, has been sanctioning Venezuela, threatens even more sanctions, and then has ready made for TV trying to force aid into the country. I mean, why don't they just drop the sanctions? That would be a good start, and that would actually help out the poorest, most affected people. I mean, we know, all three of us know, and our audience knows, sanctions is not a very precise way to have forced regime change. As a matter of fact, it almost never works, okay? And because the elites are always protected from sanctions everywhere. And the United States knows this, and that's why the Red Cross, UN agencies, were not going to get involved in bringing in aid to Venezuela because they said it's overly politicized, and it is. Go ahead in Paris.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think a number of international actors, particularly in the multilateral sphere, condemn that politicization of aid, which actually goes against international law. I mean, humanitarian aid is sacrosanct. It should not be politicized. It should be to save people. It shouldn't be as a form of manipulation to try and, in this case, turn the military around and try and make them defect. And it was I agree, it was a big media show. And I agree with the point that you made, that it's a very cynical in the context of crippling sanctions, unilateral sanctions. These are not sanctions that have been cautioned by the UN Security Council. They're US sanctions. A few of the allies sort of bandwagon with the US on this. So the Britain sort of confiscated Venezuela's gold, just
kinda,
like that, because it
yeah.
decided to confiscate $1.2 billion of Venezuelan gold. Parenthesis: We'd long when we were in government in Ecuador, we took out a gold of out of Britain because we feared just that. And it's a shame that the Venezuelans didn't do it before. They have a bad record, the Brits, on pinching other people's gold. But the US sanctions alone, I mean, it's very difficult to quantify. The Venezuelans claim it's 30 billion. A few independent economists are saying that so far it could be between 16 and 20 billion dollars damage to the Venezuelan economy. You know, this is a huge percentage of Venezuela's GDP. It's completely crippling. We know sanctions hit the poorest hardest. Always, they always have done, and certainly these will, because they're sanctions that directly affect the capacity of the Venezuelan state to live up to what it's supposed to live up to, which is, you know, cater for the social needs of the population, education, healthcare, social security, so on and so forth. And so to have this sort of billions and billions and billions of hurt produced by the sanctions, and then on the other hand, sort of very meager, just a few million. The problem is when there are too many zeros, people sort of get lost. But
yes.
The aid was actually, like 100 or even 1,000 times less than what the sanctions represent. So it was clearly political and it was clearly a manipulation. Yeah.
You know, Michael, you know, I'm sure all three of us would agree that Maduro's government has been There's a lot of corruption. Let's just say it point blank. They have a lot of problems with corruption there. But if the U.S. Under Bolton, under Trump's supervision, if that's the case, they start trying to legally transfer foreign assets, Venezuelan assets, to this random guy, Guaido, I mean, that's just another form of corruption, isn't it? I mean, it's a theft of the assets of the Venezuelan people, because these assets are property of the government. I mean, it seems quite outrageous to me that someone's dubious legitimacy is going to be given billions and billions of dollars. That's corruption as well, isn't it, Michael?
Well, Peter, I don't put it quite that way myself, but I share your concern, because and I'm more supportive of the sanctions than you and the foreign minister, but I agree with your point that it doesn't lead to an obvious outcome, and neither would giving the money to Guaido. He doesn't have a parallel government that he can run. If he had a way to give food and medicine to the people of Venezuela on a large scale, then I would contemplate supporting him, even if you complained and you pointed out that his legitimacy is also debatable. But the problem is he doesn't even have the capacity to do it, so it doesn't really make sense as an option to talk about giving money to Guaido. All it would do is sit and some bank account, or as you point out, run the risk of being misdirected.
Right. I mean, Michael, real quick.
In Guaido than you do, but he doesn't have government capacity to distribute.
Okay, I want to finish off 30 seconds with Michael. Is this overreach on part of the United States in trying to get forced regime change in Venezuela? Overreach?
No, but it's a very questionable strategy if we don't know where it's headed. So the onus is now on us to improve our own game, to work to develop a strategy with the Lima Group, hopefully with Moscow and Beijing as well, that will actually improve the well-being of the Venezuelan people, because that's the bottom line.
Okay, well, the Lima Group is directly against Venezuela, so I think we should take them off the table. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Paris, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.